You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Of course, the most damaging result and consequence of Roe v. Wade is, well, counted in the number of children that have been aborted legally in the United States since the Supreme Court made that fateful decision. There are also other consequences, and they are in some ways more difficult, in a lot of ways more difficult to see. Some of us think this is simply the way the courts and the Supreme Court are supposed to do their business. Look at the Constitution, figure out what the founders were trying to say, what they might have said in our circumstances, and then act upon that. We're going to talk about the judicial consequences of Roe v. Wade on this Monday afternoon. David French joins us, senior writer for National Review. He's a constitutional law attorney, author of the book Rise of ISIS, A Threat We Can't Ignore, and a recent column titled The Long Shadow of Roe Haunts the Supreme Court Debate. David, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Why is it that in the last several decades, and we've just seen the example with Neil Gorsuch being confirmed only because of the nuclear option that was exercised there in the Senate, why is it that almost every single Supreme Court nomination and confirmation has been so contentious?
Well, it's a three-word answer, Roe versus Wade. The shock to the system of that case is really difficult to overstate. So essentially what happened is the judges of the Supreme Court, continuing a line of cases that they had started some years before, essentially concocted not just a right, a constitutional right, not just any constitutional right, but a literal constitutional right to hire someone to kill your child in the womb out of whole cloth. I mean, this was just completely made up. It took one of the most contentious issues of public debate out of the general political sphere, out of democratic debate, and put it within the judiciary. And so that did two things. One, it meant that Roe versus Wade was going to be argued about for the, you know, for forever, essentially. And number two is it created a new world, or really solidified the creation of a new world, where judges could just kind of make up law, like the most recent Obergefell decision, where Justice Kennedy essentially made up, along with four other judges, a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. And so that raised the stakes. All of this raised the stakes of judicial confirmations immeasurably.
So are you saying, kind of at the very basic level, the Supreme Court took to itself an enormous power in
Roe?
Power
it shouldn't have.
Power it shouldn't have, and that's, and basically we have to have a mini presidential election every time we fill up space on that court. Is that contention?
Right. I mean, it raised the stakes of confirmation, and frankly, it raised the stakes of presidential elections, because what ended up happening is because the judicial branch had become so much more powerful, and because the president is the one who appoints each and every federal judge, it raised the stakes of these presidential elections, because in a presidential election, it wasn't just one of the three branches of government at stake. It became two of the three branches of government at stake, and at stake in a way that they were not constitutionally intended to be.
So talk about how it happened. Explain in a little detail for those who are not familiar with the, we'll just say, cautiously reasoning of the Roe Court, how that happened.
Well, it's part and product of the intellectual roots of the sexual revolution, along with sort of the changes in the idea of what a federal judge should do and should be. So the sexual revolution, which, you know, launched in the late 50s, early 60s, really began to transform the American landscape to the extent to which the political branches got involved with what was a cultural and religious change. And so you have a case called Griswold v. Connecticut, which established this constitutional right to contraception access. And which, again, I mean, this is something, you know, I don't think anybody, hardly anybody in the world today says, well, that government should be regulating whether or not people have access to contraception. But there's a democratic process for dealing with that. What the Supreme Court did is it short-circuited that entirely, established this right, and located it in literally the penumbras and emanations from the Bill of Rights, whatever that means. In other words, there was sort of this glow, this afterglow from the Bill of Rights that established a new constitutional right. It's a remarkable bit of judicial jujitsu, shall we say, which essentially says, well, if there's a right I can find in the actual text, then that right has sort of undefined implications from it that I can shape how I want to shape. And that was a very dangerous development, because it essentially casts every single major American public dispute into judicial terms and puts it into the province of the judiciary. So that now we're living in a world where there's virtually no fundamental reform that doesn't take place either without judicial creation of the reform or judicial branch granting permission for the reform.
Where does the concept of the living constitution enter into this whole calculus?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting phrase. And it's a phrase that's typically meant to say that there are those who believe that the Constitution of the United States should be interpreted differently as times change. So that's hence the, you know, living constitution. In other words, that there are certain, it establishes certain values and principles, and that you don't really read the text literally, but rather read the text as establishing certain values and principles, and then you interpret each case in front of you according to those values and principles. Now, the problem with that is the left really doesn't believe that. Because if the text itself establishes the values and principles that they like, then they're all about the text. If the text doesn't establish the values and principles that they like, then they're all about the evolution of the text. So what I like to say is, rather than there's a living constitution, that there's a social justice super clause. In other words, that all laws should be interpreted according to the demands and dictates of social justice. So that if the text actually matches what social justice demands, then the text controls. If the text does not match what social justice demands, then there needs to be and must be an alternative explanation or alternative interpretation of that text. The Second Amendment is a great example. There isn't really a serious historical argument for the notion that the Second Amendment protects a collective right as opposed to an individual right to keep and bear arms. In fact, the actual operative language of the amendment says the right of the people, the right of the people, which is a phrase that has always been understood to confer an individual right. The historical original public meaning of the Second Amendment is very, very clear. But that's not what social justice demands. So if social justice demands something else, well, then here's what we're going to do. We're going to go with the prefatory clause about a militia and reinterpret that as the operative clause, so that there's some sort of right to own a weapon in the context of militia service, which is completely nonsensical. But that's what social justice demands. The social justice super clause trumps the actual text.
And your point here is that this has been the way that the court, or the precedent that has been established by the Roe Court for the last 30 plus years. This way of reading the Constitution.
Well, more or less. It depends, of course. It fluctuates with the composition of the court. So, there are greater or lesser degrees. And currently, there's a sort of a 4-4 split in the court as far as whether people are more or less originalists, with Justice Kennedy being the ninth vote, and he kind of moves in between the two camps depending on the issue. This has been the debate that's dominated discourse for decades. I mean, this is kind of the debate that really was front and center in the Robert Bork nomination fight that ended up shaping the court for years to come in many different ways. And so this very foundational philosophical difference is key to understanding our court battles. And it's very key to understanding, for example, why the Democrats will often say, when they're talking about justices, well, he has a record of ruling for this person and against this person, as if that's the most important question, as opposed to what does the law say. But you have to remember, what's the social justice super clause? Well, the social justice super clause dictates that certain kinds of people should win and other certain kinds of people should lose, as opposed to a more traditional reading of the law that says, well, hey, we're going to determine who wins and loses on the basis of the text of the statute or the text of the Constitution.
So had the Roe court actually stuck to the text of the Constitution, regardless of what the lower courts had already done up to this point, and just for a moment suspending that inevitable decision from, I think it was 1965, that made Roe inevitable, as you say, had they actually just looked at the text of the Constitution, what would they have done with Roe?
Well, I mean, there would have been no ruling that there was a right, that the right of privacy and was broad enough to encompass the right to an abortion. That simply wouldn't have been the ruling. And the question of abortion would have been left up to the states. Now, interestingly enough, had that occurred, it's probable, if not almost certain, that sadly, in my view, that abortion would still be legal in the United States. There would just be very different kinds of state laws dictating abortion. So, for example, it might be available under virtually any circumstance in California, but far more heavily restricted in Mississippi. But the fact of the matter is, if Roe versus Wade were overturned tomorrow, that wouldn't abolish abortion. That would just return the decision regarding of its legality and the limits of abortion to the states.
And it wouldn't fix the court, would it?
Well, it wouldn't. I mean, nothing. There's no such thing as a permanent fix to the court, because the court is never composed of the same people now and forever. It would certainly constitute a powerful return, at least for a time being, so long as that majority existed, to the notion of interpreting the Constitution according to its text and original meaning. Now, so you never fix everything permanently. You can reverse terrible decisions, or you can, even if they're not reversed, sort of leave them into the dust of history. But you never, because these debates never end, you never fix it. You can correct some mistakes, but as far as a permanent fix, I mean, there's never a permanent fix when it comes to politics.
The crazy thing is, you actually, in your article in National Review Online, give us just a few examples of what you call more honest liberal legal scholars and their thoughts now with a little distance about Roe.
Yeah.
What did you find there?
Well, it's interesting. Even Lawrence Tribe, for example, criticized Roe's reasoning. Ruth Bader Ginsburg said there are better ways to have reached the decision. In other words, the decision itself, the actual text of the decision, was so transparently results-oriented. In other words, we're going to find a right to an abortion, and we're going to find a right to an abortion. It's not necessarily important how we get there. We're just going to find that right. And when that occurred, it led to a decision that a lot of honest liberal scholars said, wow, this is just shoddy reasoning. Now, to be clear, some of them say that there was you could have gotten the same result by using better reasoning, which I disagree with. I just think if you're going to say that there is a right to abortion in the Constitution, you're just flat out, you're just flailing, because that just flat out doesn't exist. But so some of them, it's not like they were saying, well, there was no way to find a constitutional right to abortion. They would say that was just a bad way. But it sort of does show the extent of the radicalism of that decision when you have some of the leading liberal leading liberal scholars saying, wow, that's just a bad decision, poorly written, poorly reasoned.
Does this explain why every time we have a vacancy on the court, it's the often unspoken elephant in the room, Roe? Almost every single time, it seems as though what we're really talking about is, are we going to put a person on the court who is going to threaten this very fragile mistake the court made so long ago?
Yeah, I don't think it's an unspoken elephant. I think it's always spoken. So, for example, you know, it used to be that Arlen Specter would put up a chart that showed all of the court cases that allegedly depended on Roe, and he called Roe a super-duper precedent. In other words, that it was a super important case that should not be overturned. Dianne Feinstein, this time around, kind of ratcheted that down and didn't say super-duper precedent, just said super precedent. But again, that's always coming up. They're trying to box judicial nominees into promising to respect Roe v. Wade. I mean, this is always there. This is what raises money on the left and the right. So, you know, on the left, they're raising money to oppose justices who may vote to overturn Roe. On the right, raising money to help confirm justices that they think might overturn Roe. But again, nobody really knows for sure until the case comes up in front of the judge.
David French is our guest, senior writer for National Review. We're talking about the judicial consequences of Roe v. Wade. When we come back, we'll talk about how Roe is taught in law schools. One of the topics we're going to take up at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference this summer, June 9th and 10th, here in Collinsville, Illinois, is going to be natural law, an idea that used to underpin much of our thinking about the laws we made in this country and simply doesn't anymore. Making the Case for Natural Law will be Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine at the 5th Annual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 9th and Saturday, June the 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. He's going to be joined by fellow Issues Etc. regular guests Matt Harrison, Chris Roseborough, Terry Mattingly, Peter Bender, and Todd Peppercorn. Registration for the conference is $120 and includes three meals. You can find out more and register at issuesetc.org or make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc. Send it to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. That's Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please write Summer Conference on the memo line of your check. It's the premier conference for Christian laity, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. On the other side of the break, if you're going to law school to become a lawyer, and then many of those lawyers go on to become judges, how are you taught about Roe v. Wade?
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit MemoriaPressAcademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all. We're talking about the judicial consequences of Roe v. Wade with David French, senior writer for National Review, a constitutional law attorney, author of the book Rise of ISIS, A Threat We Can't Ignore, and a recent column titled The Long Shadow of Roe Haunts the Supreme Court Debate. David, let's go back to kind of the beginning of kind of some of the legal instruction for many of those who will sit on the court. How is Roe taught in law schools?
Well, you know, as a general matter, since most law schools are overwhelmingly liberal, it's sort of taught as part of this march towards justice and equality. So, you know, in the context of, it's taught in a context very similar to the way civil rights cases are taught, or say, Brown versus Board of Education, that this is part of how the judiciary sort of led America out of the darkness of oppression and led America out of the darkness of inequality. And how justices and judges can be moral leaders and can be, you know, can essentially, you know, they're on the right side of history. There isn't a lot of emphasis on teaching how it's consistent with constitutional jurisprudence then or now. It's a very results-oriented process. Now, they'll go back and they'll talk about Griswold and how Griswold built up into Roe, and they'll talk about the reasoning and the argument in Roe and in Griswold. But the overwhelming sort of tenor of the debate and the discussion is, we'll look at all the social justice these judges accomplished.
Have both left and right become dependent on this judicial power?
I would say this. I would say yes, but to different extents. The left uses the judicial power as sort of a one-way ratchet towards social justice. In other words, with each new quote-unquote advance, they're trying to set a new legal and cultural reality that America cannot move away from. The right often uses the judiciary as a fail-safe for the cowardice of our own legislators. In other words, rather than repeal bad laws or repeal bad regulations, they will hope, cross their fingers and hope that the courts will rule against those bad laws and bad regulations and bail them out. So, you know, one of the interesting things that's we're going to see is, to what extent does the Trump administration actually roll back some of the worst and most radical executive directives of the Obama administration, some of which were, for example, are resulting in systematic due process violations on college campuses, or, you know, other edicts from the Obama administration? How much are they going to actually roll those back, which they have the power to do, or how much are they going to just let the courts decide and hope the courts decide correctly? That's going to be a very interesting question over the next 12 months or so.
You have used the term results-oriented several times to talk about both Roe and the subsequent court decisions. I'm thinking about a quote from Neil Gorsuch himself, who said, and I paraphrase, if a judge or a justice does not find himself ruling against his own policy preferences on occasion, he's probably not a very good judge. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, that's a shorthand way of knowing whether or not a person is applying the law or rewriting the law. I think it's easy for conservatives to sometimes believe that liberal judges always come out the way they want to come out. I've been practicing law for a long time, and I know that there are many liberal judges who have ruled against what I would think would be the parties and the causes that they prefer, because the law is very, very clear. It's not that the text doesn't matter, but the problem, what we've seen, is the greater the stakes of the case, in other words, the more important the case is to the culture, the more important the case is to the left side of the aisle, the greater the temptation is for the judge to depart from the actual text of the law. And I will say that that temptation exists on the right as well. However, there's a culture on the right that is much more conducive to saying, look, we just apply the law as written. If you don't like the law, change the law. Don't tell the judges to change the law.
Finally, coming back to where we began, we spoke about the nuclear option being exercised during the Gorsuch confirmation. Was the elimination of the filibuster on Supreme Court nominations, was it a good thing or a bad thing?
Way too early to tell. Way, way too early to tell. Ask me in a century, because then we'll see, you know, 20 more or 15 other judges nominated, and we'll know what the jurisprudence of the court has been over time. I'll just say this. I think that America has become so polarized that the filibuster was increasingly an unrealistic legislative procedure. An unrealistic legislative environment was created by the filibuster. It was based on a world that does not exist anymore. And that world that doesn't exist right now is a world that said on critical and important questions, there can be meaningful compromise. And with the level of polarization we have in this country, on critical and important questions, the possibility of compromise is greatly diminished. And so the filibuster was built on the presumption that compromise was possible. I think eliminating it is based on a very real world, real politique view that says, well, we're just not in a place where compromise is possible. And if we're going to govern this country, then the filibuster is something that's going to have to go. And it'll be very interesting to see if the legislative filibuster survives either this presidency or the next presidency.
I guess that raises one more question, and that is, you know, up to this point, our legislators, especially the Senate, have operated with kind of their 80% rule. If I can agree with 80% of a bill, then I'll vote for it. I don't have to agree with 100%. But that seems to be going by the wayside, too, in terms of things done legislatively. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, and I would even say it's not about substance anymore as much. It's about tribe. So the question is not, okay, on this given policy, do I agree with 80% or do I not agree with 80%? It's who advanced this policy and who will benefit politically from it. And if the answer is my side did not advance it and my side won't be the primary political benefactor from the policy, then I'm going to be against it. And I think that's how tribal we're becoming. So, for example, one of the interesting things that we're seeing is there's this possibility that Trump may come out with a really big infrastructure bill. Now, that's a classic Democratic maneuver, big public work spending. And we could be in this interesting parallel universe where Paul Ryan is helping push a infrastructure bill that Nancy Pelosi is opposing because Donald Trump pushed it, and it would be seen, and its success would be seen as benefiting Donald Trump. And so we're getting that tribal where ideology itself matters less than tribe. And so the question isn't, do I agree with them 80%? It's, do I even like this other person and want to see them succeed?
David French is senior writer for National Review, a constitutional law attorney, author of the book Rise of ISIS, A Threat We Can't Ignore, and a recent column titled The Long Shadow of Roe Haunts the Supreme Court Debate. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. David, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series on Lutheran identity, talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about the Book of Concord, the Lutheran Confessions, one of those hallmarks, the hallmark of Lutheran identity. And we'll have Pastor Tom Baker of Law and Gospel lead us in a Sunday school lesson on Jesus appearing to Thomas in John chapter 20. Why did Thomas have to see Jesus? We know that why he wanted to see Jesus risen from the dead, but Jesus complies and shows himself to Thomas as well. Why did that need to happen? We'll answer that question tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Repentance and forgiveness, sin and grace, law and gospel. More than cliches, real preaching for real people in need of hearing the real Christ. Christ for you and the divine service at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, where we gather every Saturday night at 6 and on the Lord's Day, Sunday mornings at 7:45 and 10. Look for the Church of the Neon Cross on I-55 between exits 30 and 33. Find us on the web, stpaullutheranchurchhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, where there is the forgiveness of sins, life and salvation for the people of God.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship, or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc., write scholarship in the memo line, and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.